My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Walter Hagrids, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about the second part of our conversation on what will the world look like in 2050. Last week, we got a little bit excited about analyzing the past 100 years and trying to figure out where past generations have gone wrong in predicting the future, and we wanted to learn from their mistakes in order to avoid them today. So, Balder, after last week's episode, do you think we will overemphasize negative trends of today just like they did in the 1950s?
Hi, Dario. Well, that is obviously a risk with us, right? We have a tendency in this podcast to be relatively critical / negative about the world. And we have to be careful not to go down that path. But then again, I mean, the Western bubble is all about saying there's something deeply wrong with the way that Western liberal democracies have behaved. So it would be, let's say, surprising if the outcome of this episode is one of positivity and hope about the future. But who knows?
And for this, we've structured today's episode into three different parts, right? First, we want to talk about some broad dynamics we have identified. And we will try to take the hype out of it, right? To not repeat mistakes of the past. Then we are going to try to create some scenarios, almost some, right? Some quasi predictions in that sense. And at the end, I think it makes sense to look at some practical cases of today's world, right? And see, oh, are we heading towards more conflicts, fewer conflicts? How are they going to be dealt with? And I would say that we jump right in.
Well, I just want to say the usual sort of disclaimer that predicting the future is an impossible exercise in many ways, right? It's always easier afterwards to assess whether any predictions were correct, as we did last week, than what we're going to do today. This is more a exercise in just thoughts about possible scenarios, right? And I'm saying this in order to avoid 10 years down the line someone clipping a prediction by me or by you and showing how wrong we were, because of course, you know, the future is unclear to anyone who tries to understand it.
Unless you have some super AI in the next 25 years that will help us predict the future, but that's already going into a dystopian scenario.
I had an interesting conversation about that a couple of weeks ago, that would only be the case if that super AI is endogenous, if that super AI actually influences the future itself. So it predicts and then it makes the future become like itself. Because even with the super AI, there is simply no way to account for random events, right?
I'm smelling a future episode here, but let's focus on the episode that we have in front of us today. And that is, well, starting out with some broad dynamics we've identified while taking the hype out of it, right? And obviously the overall dynamic that we've been talking about for the last few months is the fact that the transatlantic alliance is broken, right? No more. Ciao, cacao. It's donezo. We've broken up.
Yeah. Of course, a lot of people are claiming that this is just a Trumpian thing. It just depends on Donald Trump. But once a other, maybe Democratic president comes in, that will change. But that would be incorrect analysis, if you ask me, because what is happening now is a breakup that cannot be restored, because every time that a more pro-transatlantic president comes into the White House, Europeans and Canadians and the Japanese and the South Koreans will ask themselves, yeah, okay, but what about 4 years from now? Will there be another Trump? Basically, the United States has broken up with the transatlantic alliance, has broken up with Europe, and Europe is kind of embracing that and has to embrace this. But that has enormous consequences for the future for everyone around the world, right? Because the transatlantic alliance has been this overwhelmingly dominant force in geopolitics.
One of the major things in the last few months has been the rise of oligarchy in the United States, right? With the likes of Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg. And the question here is, right, are we moving into 25 years of global oligarchy, right? Of basically all these tech billionaires from the United States, but also from other countries, right? Kind of connecting, doing their things. And we're just being ruled by billionaires from soon onwards.
Yeah, I would argue that most of this episode hinges on the question, what will be the relationship between leaders and citizens in the Western world, but also in a country like China, in India. You see all around the world this readjustment of what the state is supposed to be towards citizens. And this is where oligarchy comes in. Because, of course, we have seen 25 years of very rapid rise of these big tech, big multinationals that are hugely influential in global politics everywhere, but specifically will have a lot of power, will wield a lot of power in situations such as the United States in 2025, because there's an administration that is very open to them, that doesn't see the state as a barrier of oligarchic tendencies, in fact, that embraces oligarchic tendencies. And that changes the relationship between people and the state, right? So a lot of the conversations we're going to have in the next half hour, 45 minutes, will be about that. What will the future hold in terms of power balance between, on the one hand, citizens, the other hand, state, and then there's no third hand, what is that? Food? big money, right? Oligarchy. And kind of the cheap money, the fast money is now on, oh, we are going to this world where in 25 years' time, Elon Musk or Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos basically run the world and we are just puppets in it.
I mean, this is something we're already seeing in other countries with, let's say, more authoritarian regimes, where right, big tech is kind of helping out the governments in controlling and oppressing its citizens. So I assume that's one of those kind of one of those shifts in the relationship between leaders and citizens, particularly in the West, is that are we going to see more oppression of citizens? Because looking at the United States right now, it sure does seem like it.
Yeah, so you have a situation where the state becomes increasingly reliant on these multinationals. And again, that goes against the fundamental idea of the state being a buffer against other types of power, right? The state is the place where citizens come together and they protect themselves against a centralization of power elsewhere. And so right now, that kind of protection is disappearing because the state is way too close, way too incestuous with these large companies that have very much different agendas than your average citizen. Now, like I said, the easy prediction would be that is what the world is going to be like in 25 years' time. I'm not completely convinced, because one of the problems of this kind of oppression, like oligarchic oppression that you start seeing more and more, is that at some point it destroys itself. It eats itself from the inside out, right? One of the big problems with capitalism that is unregulated, so if you have a model where there is no regulation and you just let capitalism do its thing, is that it collapses the very system it depends on. That's why even if you're a hardcore capitalist, you need to embrace certain levels of regulation to make sure that companies don't destroy the system they need. And even though a lot of articles currently are written about warning us for that long-term oligarchy, there is a clear other scenario that is in many ways much more interesting. Oligarchy rises in the next 10 years or so. Money becomes more and more powerful until at some point it just doesn't work anymore and the system cannot sustain itself. And at that moment, either revolution or something else occurs. But it seems very unlikely that we go into a direction where 50 years down the line, we are just the puppets of a few billionaires.
I was going to say, because a counter-revolution doesn't seem very likely, given that there's no movement, right? No collective movement for this at the moment. And at the same time, it's not like 100 years ago where you can just take your pitchforks and kind of run towards a palace. No, if there's no way for you to kind of organize, because the platforms for organization are controlled by exactly those billionaires, and let's say you have kind of facial recognition cameras everywhere and drones, and then a quasi-oppressive state kind of going against you, then good luck with your revolution, because they will be done.
Well, that is absolutely true. It's also very clear that citizens nowadays are less equipped in many ways to see these dark clouds coming than they used to be, let's say, in the 20th century. This has not to do with information availability, because there's more information available to your average citizen than ever before, but it's got to do with the ability to rationally analyze the situation, to assess their own interest versus other interests. Citizens are much more prone to manipulation than they used to be. They've got a much more emotional connection with politics rather than a rational connection with politics. New generations, because of social media and technology, find it very, very difficult to actually think critically without falling into tribalism. You're absolutely right. There are a lot of reasons to be skeptical of revolution coming up. At the very minimum, if a revolution happens, we don't see any serious signs of that yet, right? I mean, if a revolution is coming in the next 10, 20 years, there are no signs as what you would have seen in the 18th century before the French Revolution. Before the French Revolution, you had decades of unrest. You had decades of revolt, not revolution, but revolt, and little rebellions and uprisings and that kind of thing. And that currently is completely lacking. But even if revolution doesn't take place, it still seems unlikely that the oligarchy that is coming up right now, that is clearly becoming more powerful and is clearly establishing itself as a recognizable force, is going to be sustainable, simply because the wealth of Elon Musk, the wealth of Jeff Bezos, the wealth of all these people comes from a place where liberal democracy allowed them to accumulate that wealth. That wealth generation will at some point stop if the system comes to a halt, right? If the system no longer functions. This is me also trying to be a little bit more interesting, right? Because the boring thing would be to say, of course, in the next 25 years, democracy is gone and oligarchy is the only thing left in town.
Well, I mean, so far we've spoken a lot about the relationship kind of from the leader's perspective towards its citizens and this new intermediary of billionaires. But at the same time, citizens are also changing their relationship towards their leaders, because they're starting to disconnect emotionally from them and, quite frankly, going crazy.
Yeah, and this is exactly the driving force behind a very uncertain and, if you like, dark future. Over the past 300 years, citizens have become slowly more equipped to have a responsible power balance with the state. And that is absolutely fundamental for any governance system, whether it's authoritarian or liberal. And unfortunately, in the 21st century, that has fallen off a cliff. Citizens find it extremely difficult to assess their own responsibility in society at the moment. They find it extremely difficult to assess what their obligation is towards the state and what the state is obligated to do towards them. It is too much of an emotional roller coaster for citizens at the moment. Either they disconnect, they say, I don't want to hear about it, too many problems, it depresses me, don't bother me, I've got mental health issues. Or they say, no, I want to be part of this, but then they become tribal. So they go all out on Donald Trump, in favor or against. They go all out rather than demanding good governance from the state. And that is exactly the concerning aspect, right? So even if I just try to make the case tentatively that maybe oligarchy isn't the future, that doesn't mean that good governance is the future. Because for good governance, you need that balance between citizenry and the state. And that balance is completely gone. It is very visible in the way that people vote, in the way that people behave, in the way that articles are written in newspapers, that people have lost focus on what's important. Namely, it doesn't really matter whether it's left or right wing. It matters whether the state functions properly, functions correctly. And right now, the state is not functioning correctly. And half of the citizens are okay with that because their tribe is running the state. And the other half are against it, not because of good governance concerns, but because they don't like the rival tribe to be in power. And that is a real problem.
And that disconnect between leadership and its citizens will lead to, or may lead to, some form of revolution. Because the moment that one of the tribe in power realizes that, I assume there will be a point, right? When the tribe in power realizes that we have been screwed, right? Things have not gotten better for us despite promises. And then they will turn away from their own tribe. But I don't think they're going to turn towards the other tribe either. They will just be that disconnect. And the moment that there's this disconnect, then we're looking at revolution.
Yeah, either disconnect or radicalize further, right? In some ways, it's a vicious circle. So populist leaders, which I'm happy to posit, are typically not the conduit to good governance. A populist leader like Donald Trump is now going to make life worse for his own voters, for his own tribe. It's already happening. The consequences of Donald Trump are going to be felt throughout American society. And in 4 years' time, the United States will be worse off, especially the voters who actually voted for Trump. Now, what they're going to do is they're not going to assess, oh, maybe I was wrong in my thinking. Maybe I should now vote for a less populist leader and a leader that is more serious about good governance, the foundations of liberal democracy. No, what they will do is they will feel betrayed by Trump or feel betrayed by the people around Trump and then go to an even more extreme version of Trump, who then promises to correct everything, right? That kind of lack of self-critical recognition, that lack of inability to steer yourself back to good citizenry is something that that's going to break up society at some point. The only thing is that we don't really know what that breakup will look like. So one scenario is oligarchy, another scenario is revolution. But as you said, first of all, there are lots of anti-revolutionary systems in place right now. It's easier to control the world. And secondly, we're not seeing the signs of revolution. Historically, we would now be seeing some kind of upheaval, and there's no such upheaval, especially not in the United States. I think for a lot of Europeans, it's been very surprising, not in a good way, to see how little reaction there is from American society to what's happening right now, to what the White House is doing. How little actual revolt is visible. And if that's not visible now, then it's very hard to see a revolution taking place in the near future. So then if we don't have oligarchy and we don't have revolution and we don't have good governance, what will the world look like in 20, 25 years' time? It's very difficult to assess.
From the control of the United States, right, towards a multipolar world. And that's another one of those, right, broad visible trends, is that we're moving towards this world where you will have, right, kind of one pole of the United States, one of the EU, right? They're no longer connected. Something that I'm not sure whether I would have said 6 months ago, if you had asked me to describe a multipolar world, I would have said, oh, clearly the West and then some others, right? But so you have now two different poles, the United States, the EU, Russia, China, India, Brazil, Indonesia, and Nigeria, and maybe some others, who knows? I mean, I'm pretty sure there's some other strong contenders that we haven't mentioned here. But at the same time, right, because none of them, to me, seem like within the next 25 years, they will kind of make that move for that global superpower, and we will see a somewhat unipolar world again, right? Because China, for an example, right, maybe the strongest contender, they're also facing some serious problems within them that maybe a bursting the China bubble, or the Chinese bubble podcast from within China should analyze soon.
Yes, and before we get into that, I do want to point out that the likely future is basically non-polar, right? So not just multipolar, but it's one where none of these that you mentioned is really capable of properly influencing global relations actively. So they basically, you get into a situation where all these countries that you just listed are likely to be on a sea adrift, and they can't control the sea, right? Because there are also those technological dynamics, there are the oligarchical tendencies, there are all these movements, and you will no longer have a world where there are a few central powers that can steer the world into their own direction. And China, as you mentioned, is the very, very obvious example. There are very dark clouds on the horizon for China. China has established itself as the second most powerful nation on Earth, maybe in the future the first. That's not a crazy idea, looking at how the United States is going at the moment. But China is no longer this simple force that can't be stopped. In fact, internally, there is rot in the system. There are huge demographic problems. Economic growth is nowhere near as high as it was 10, 15 years ago. And as a result, it's harder for the government to essentially invest in the middle class, which means that there's going to be internal lack of cohesion at some point. It's going to be harder for the Chinese government to appease the masses. There is also a very clear trend towards power centralization in China, which is not a good sign, right? The Chinese success story was based on relatively sophisticated factionalism. And now the way that Xi has centralized power around himself, it leads to a future where China will not be able to react to the complexity of the world. So yes, China is a very, very powerful country. It's likely to stay very powerful unless some kind of internal revolution or rebellion takes place there. But again, we don't see any signs of that. But that is not to say that China is going to conquer the world. In fact, the opposite is likely. I think that China is also reaching kind of its high point of influence right now and is going to be superseded by India and by Indonesia and other countries you mentioned.
I mean, India is truly not in the next 25 years, right? Because I think in the next 25 years, we will continue to see India arise and become more important. But I would say that there are still too many, right, internal struggles, right? Because you don't have that amount of control that the Chinese government has over its 1.3 billion population. In India, you don't really have that. It's in that sense, it's a bit more natural, kind of like in its development. But I think India is more a strong contender for 2075.
Possibly. The question, that, I mean, 2075 is very far away from now, right? I mean, we might all be dead by then. I mean, it's a lot of things can happen. 25 years is kind of the maximum that I can look ahead. Beyond that, it becomes hard. But the issue that India faces right now is that it has gone through a relatively radical transformation in terms of who it wants to be, right? India had a relatively well-established identity until the Modi government came into power. They kind of knew that they were a state that would not play the usual geopolitical games, but that would do business with everyone, an important player in the non-alignment movement, relatively neutral positioning towards any kind of geopolitical fights, and it would as a result get on with things and not be hindered by unnecessary conflicts or rivalry. That was kind of the India's approach. But now, over the past 15 years, India has gone through this transformation internally but also externally about being a much more clearly defined state, for better or worse, right? I mean, I would argue as an outsider, anytime I hear something like Hindu nationalism, just like I hear Christian nationalism or anything like that, I get very nervous, especially for a country with the size and diversity and complexity of India. And it's not completely clear whether India is going to be able to stabilize that, right? So Modi is relatively popular. Modi has managed to get a lot of political mileage out of this change. But at some point, relatively soon, Modi is going to no longer be there. Will India then have this consolidated identity, or will it now get into an identity crisis? If that identity crisis doesn't happen, if Modi has actually set in motion a dynamic that is permanent and relatively stable, then India might be one of the winners of the next, you know, of the foreseeable future.
Before we continue kind of through that list, right, where both of us aren't really experts, I think we can safely say that we've identified the current broad dynamics, and I really hope that we were able to kind of take the hype out of it. I do think on a certain level we've done that. And from here I would like to move on to kind of the next stage where we start offering speculations, predictions, right? It's a slippery slope. based on these trends that we've identified, right? So kind of the key defining like issue will be how does the relationship between leaders and citizens develop, right? The move away from that unipolar world towards a multipolar
or non-polar world.
Exactly. Right. So then the question is, okay, then we need to look at a few different elements, right, that we are currently seeing in our world, right, in the international relations that I'm currently looking at. And we need to ask ourselves the questions, okay, which of these elements have been dependent on this world so far? Because given that it's changing, these elements will change as well, right? And the easiest one here, given the decline of the West, right, and that breaking apart of that one pole between the United States and kind of the and Europe would be NATO, because they have very much been dependent on this world.
Yeah, NATO by definition is fully dependent on the Transatlantic Alliance. It's called North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Without that Atlantic Treaty, then there's no organization.
Was that a Freudian slip?
Yeah, it was a bit of a Freudian slip, you know. I also always struggle with different languages in Dutch and in French. It's slightly different in order. So yeah, there you go. NATO is absolutely dependent on the Transatlantic Alliance, and of course it's very unlikely to survive. I mean, already this past week, Europeans have been trying to find a way to make NATO work without the United States, which is insanity. I mean, a European Defense Force might be a thing. That could work. But NATO without the United States is not NATO. It doesn't exist. It doesn't make any sense. So NATO is going to go down. And to be honest, this is not because of the past 3 months, or at least not just because of the past 3 months. It is something that was happening for a very long time. Again, 10 years ago, NATO was also on the brink. People were saying, why does NATO exist? Ukraine gave it a little bit of new life, but the long-term trend is for NATO to slowly disappear into irrelevance. And now with the Trump administration and the events between Europe and the United States, it's very obvious that NATO is accelerating its decline into oblivion. This is not necessarily going to be a matter of NATO in 2026 or 2027 just closing shop, but it's more a matter of becoming slowly irrelevant, right? Existing as a shell organization, but nobody believes in it anymore, nobody cares about it, but that's going to be a slow process and also a difficult process, especially for Europeans who have been so dependent on it.
A little bit like the OSCE, right? Because I think that's one of those examples where, I mean, it used to work pretty well, right? It was one, I always called it the most efficient international organization because based on the small budget they actually had a big impact. But since that relationship between Russia and the West broke down, they're completely irrelevant. I mean, I think they're still meeting and there's still some people employed, but they're not doing anything.
And there are a lot of these examples, right, throughout history, not just now, but also in the 20th century, that these organizations that were set up, it's hardly ever politically convenient to say we're going to completely shut it down because that leads to all kinds of complex conversations. But year after year after year, it basically disappears into the mists of time. And at some point, somewhere, now I can say 2075, someone is just going to be the last person in the building and turns off the lights of NATO, you know, and that's about it. And nobody will have noticed because nobody will have thought of NATO over the past 20 years, right? So this is very likely the future of NATO. NATO doesn't make any sense anymore. It is still an incredibly efficient machine and it's still going to be around for a long time because of that. But you see countries transitioning out of NATO until at some point nobody has ever thought about it anymore. And the last bit of budget is basically cut and the electricity bill can no longer be paid and that's it.
I feel so bad for Sweden and Finland, right? They resisted the urge to join NATO for so long. Then Russia invades Ukraine and suddenly the perceived need is there, right? That they need to join as well. And then what? A year later, they're basically turning it off, right? And being like, hey, thanks for joining. Like, it's like you coming to a party, but all the beer is already empty, and now you can drink tap water and talk to some stoners in the corner, and that's your party experience.
True, to give them some hope, it might facilitate their transition into, for example, European Defense Force. Right, being part of NATO now allows them to be part of the conversations that are happening, and it makes it easier for them to join any kind of defense mechanisms that are being set up. Because if they were not in NATO, then their inclusion in, for example, a European Defense Force kind of conversation would be more problematic. Now it's like it's natural for them to be at the table. So just to give them a little bit of a feeling that it wasn't all in vain, it might make the transition easier. But yeah, I mean, of course, joining NATO now is kind of the worst moment imaginable.
Yeah, I'm always a little bit too harsh on my Scandinavian neighbors and friends, but let's be honest, that's just my jealousy of them. They're just better at so many things that we do. But moving on from NATO, right? Because I think NATO is one of those organizations where the moment that the main player no longer sees the kind of the usefulness of it, then it just dies down. With regards, there's other international organizations where I think they will be deemed more useful, and therefore they might have a chance of survival in some way, shape, or form. And that would be an organization like the World Health Organization or like the World Trade Organization, right? Where we kind of see, like, I mean, they're useful, right? It's useful to have an organization that kind of says, oh, hey, guys, there is a little virus spreading around there. Maybe we should create a response, because otherwise we might have this pandemic thing again and no one likes that. Or the World Trade Organization, where, right, it's good if we want to live in a world where we trade with each other and we all make more money, to have some rules that everyone abides by. I mean, so those two organizations are useful, but they were also created by the West. So the question I have here is, if the West is no longer kind of enforcing them, will they be changed by that multi or non-polar world?
Look, if you were to design a global community from scratch, just start with a blank sheet and say, how do we want a global community, especially Westphalian world, to behave, to organize itself, you're gonna want to have something called the World Health Organization. You're gonna want something that's called the World Trade Organization. You're gonna have something similar to maritime law or something like that. There are a number of issues that just make practical, rational sense that are not culturally or politically dependent. The problem is exactly what you just mentioned, that these were mechanisms that were established by a victorious West in the 20th century who were preparing for a world that was liberal, democratic, capitalist. And even though absolutely a World Health Organization or World Trade Organization makes perfect sense for everyone, the very identity of these organizations from their very foundation is Western and liberal. Now, you see countries like China and to a lesser extent India trying to get a foot in the door, to basically say, we now want to shape it in our own image. We're trying to influence them, just like we're trying to influence the United Nations in a way that is not dependent on that kind of Western arrogance, that Western hegemony, etc., etc. Whether it is possible to do that is a different question, right? If an organization from the very, very beginning is so Western focused, if you take that identity out of it, the only thing you've got left is a shell. And then how do you give it a new identity? How do you give it a new driver? China can say, we want a clearer, bigger voice at the table. Sure, that makes perfect rational sense. But how do you do that without an India and Brazil and Nigeria also saying, okay, we want our voice heard as well? It becomes much harder to essentially establish a new identity rather than one that was there since the very beginning. So even though, rationally speaking, it would make perfect sense for those organizations to survive into the long term, I would, just also to give some interesting predictions, predict that over the next 25 years they will see a similar decline, simply because that driving force is gone, the West is gone, and they will not be able to internally replace that in a cohesion way. So they will continue existing, but they will not be a forceful organization that actually fulfills the needs of global citizens.
Well, I just had a thought. What if, let's say, China were to approach the world and say, hey, the World Trade Organization is a useful tool, but we really want to reform it because it's inherently Western. As of now, in 2025, I'm sure that the Western world would say, how dare you, right? This is such a useful tool, and you're just being crazy, right? But is that still the case in 10, 15 years? Right. So in 10, 15 years before, I mean, right out of the fear that China might set up its own World Health Organization, right, together with India and some others, that then the West is more in a worse negotiating position and actually says, well, OK, we can talk about this.
No, absolutely. That is an extremely likely scenario. The West might still have some remnant, you know, latent kind of urges to claim that they represent universality and that the World Health Organization is and the World Trade Organization are completely universal and are not at all culturally dependent. In the foreseeable future, that's obviously going to change because the West will no longer have that same power to basically block any serious reform. That is not a concern. I don't think the West is going to be the reason why the World Health Organization, World Trade Organization are not going to survive in the long term. The problem is that to have such a global organization set up, you need sufficient power to basically establish it with a clear identity. And as we said at the beginning of this episode, however influential China and India will be, they will not be as powerful as the West in the 1940s, 1950s. So they will not have the strength to basically say to the global community, this is how it is. Like it or leave it, this is you're going to have to accept that these organizations are going to be there and they're going to be running global affairs. The West could only do that because of that exceptional moment of power that they had and that is now completely gone. And so China and India will try to reform it, and Brazil and all the others will try to reform it. They will try to make it generally more universal or more in their own image. And I predict that they will fail in that in the long run. Because you cannot just make something truly universal simply because there are too many voices at the table.
At the beginning, we spoke about the role of those tech billionaires kind of becoming oligarchs. Do you think they know that their entire wealth and power is based on a global world where, I mean, they rely very much on kind of free trade, right? On the organizations that have been created. And they are currently the ones who are dismantling them, right? It seems like they don't really know what the basis of their wealth is. And so will they be struggling because their business models are being undermined by this?
Well, that's exactly what we referred to before. And that's the one thing that I find so surprising. So I have never met any of these billionaires. I've met a few billionaires, but not those. And what I don't understand is they got so successful through a relatively well-functioning model. which was relatively regulated, and there's a reason for it to be regulated. So whenever Jeff Bezos goes against trade unions, for example, doesn't he realize that the whole system of trade unions was an essential part in why he became as wealthy and rich as he is? Yes, it is a bit inconvenient because it takes a bit of power away from you, but that power balance is exactly what keeps the model sustainable. So that's exactly what I referred to at the beginning, that they are actually undermining their own success story. At some point, by taking control and taking away the ability for states to actually regulate and create some kind of balance in global society, certainly in Western society, they are actually moving towards a future where their whole business model collapse. And you know, I'm sure that they will always have a few billion stored away, so they're going to be fine. But the success that they've had over the past 20 years was because of the model that they're in right now fighting. And that makes it so insane to me. That makes it so crazy to see them cozy up to a Trump administration that's taking a sledgehammer and breaking down everything that has been built up over the past 400 years. How much harm can you do to your own success? It's very difficult for me to understand, but that's exactly what's happening. Hence my prediction that even though it is such an easy thing to say that in the next 25 years we're all going to be part of some kind of oligarchy, that might actually not happen. Oligarchy is just not clever enough. It's not intelligent enough to understand why it is powerful and where its success comes from.
Don't let them know that, right? Don't tell them that, hey, you're not smart enough. They might turn off. They might turn off this podcast.
Elon. Sorry, we love you. You are an amazing person. You are our personal Lord and Savior. And
well, based on all of our criticism of Donald Trump, if a U.S. border guard listens to this podcast and we try to enter the United States, I'm not so sure whether we would be able to enter it at the moment. But that's the topic for next week's episode.
I can tell you, I already had difficulty entering because of a past in Libya and other countries. Now it will be very hard for me. I'm serious. Yeah.
Yeah. It's wow. The United States on the same level as Libya. Lovely. the last point I want to talk about here is, to what extent has the Westphalian model dependent on the West being in charge, right? So again, for context, right, the fact that we have borders right now, the fact that we don't cross these borders without permission, and the fact that we don't intervene with the business of other states in other borders, I mean, that's something that's also Western, but isn't that already too ingrained and too useful, right? Even more useful than the World Trade Organization for us to, or for other countries to say, oh, you know, this is Westphalian model is no longer working. Let's get rid of it. And right, no borders.
There, it's probably important to make a very clear distinction about the Westphalian model being Eurocentric or Euro determined, because it is a European invention from 1648, from the 17th century, based on European realities that then spread to the entire world, but not necessarily dependent on Western liberalism, democratic liberalism, right? And exactly as you said, it is Westphalia, even though it was basically a European system imposed on everyone else through the colonial times, through the enormous dominance, global dominance that Western powers exerted in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. Right now, it is so ingrained in the system. Everyone kind of accepts broadly borders. There are some disputes, but generally we accept the borders of states. We also know the identity of states. It seems very unlikely that the Westphalian system will disappear, especially because we don't have an alternative. The only kind of broad alternative that seems reasonable, as in likely to happen, is anarchy, which is not a reasonable model at all, but that is a reasonable prediction, right? That it all collapses and basically it doesn't matter anymore what rules we believe exist, because all of that implicit kind of understanding of humanity is gone. So we would see a world where basically it is going to Hobbes's nightmare, you know, where life is nasty, brutish, and short, that kind of thing. But without that, if there's still some kind of control by some kind of actors in the world by the end of the 21st century, then that is very likely to be based still on Westphalia.
You just mentioned that there's some minor disagreements between certain countries about those borders. I think that's a very great kind of transition towards the last part of this episode, and that's the practical cases. Because, for an example, India and Pakistan, they're not so friendly with each other always. Based on the entire analysis throughout the episode, what do we think is going to happen here? I mean, are they right? I mean, luckily, it seems like that the peace or the absence of war between those two is not so much dependent on the West, but rather on nuclear weapons.
Yeah, nuclear weapons have stabilized the relationship to a certain degree, not in terms of friendship, but in terms of simply knowing that conventional warfare is kind of pointless, or at least very risky, because if you have too much success, and that would most likely be India having too much conventional success towards Pakistan, because India is, of course, the dominant player here, then Pakistan will start hitting nuclear buttons. So that kind of has a destabilizing force over the past 30 years or so. with only skirmishes taking place, but no longer full-blown wars. Now, what will matter and is difficult to predict is whether India's identity that we've just mentioned, that Modi has initiated, that identity change into a much more well-defined but also kind of aggressive actor on the global stage, will make the behavior of India more predatory, right? Become more like trying to get their way through military coercion, through etc. That has not been India's way generally, except for, you know, arguably the situation around Kashmir, but that might become more of a factor to take into account. However, of all the conflicts in the world, Pakistan-India is one of the least concerning to me, simply because they've got such a long history, it's been so established, and we have seen a decrease in violence over the past few generations. So I would not predict any war breaking out there.
But no. That's different with regards to China and Taiwan, because, I mean, there, if anything, we've kind of seen escalation is a strong word, right? But a slow kind of increase in tensions.
Yes, and there it's sort of a similar issue as with Modi in India. So strategically, rationally speaking, if you are a purely rational Chinese actor and you just think about the well-being of Chinese citizens, annexing Taiwan by force, using military violence in order to get Taiwan to come back into the fold from a Chinese perspective, is a huge blunder. The costs are way higher than any benefits that you get out of it. However, the one thing that should make us doubt a little bit is that Xi seems to be connecting his identity very much. Xi needs to somehow still solidify his legacy. And he has tried to do that through the Belt and Road Initiative, which has had some success here and there, but is not spectacular enough to say, oh, what an amazing leader. 100 years from now, we will still be talking about him. And if he manages to somehow incorporate, annex Taiwan, that might actually, from his perspective, do it. So that is the only doubt that you would have, because if you take the Xi factor away, my prediction would always be no way that China annexes Taiwan. It's just not going to happen. It's way too costly, way too complex, way too much potential for things going horribly wrong. But now, knowing that Xi is so determined, is so attaching his reputation onto this question, you know, it might actually happen, especially with the United States no longer being a guarantor. The Trump is not going to start World War III in order to protect Taiwan. So that's, you know, that could change a little bit the dynamic there. So I would find it very difficult to make a prediction here. My prediction would very tentatively still be no, because China typically doesn't use its military for foreign policy. It has been quite consistent in not militarizing foreign policy. It has been a very unaggressive, is that a word? Unaggressive? Unaggressive nation in terms of global politics in that sense. But it is a scary prediction to make because there are some signs that China might actually want to do something.
Well, and then lastly, liberal democracy. Will that one survive? Because we've kind of spoken about it like it won't.
I hope that Europe can still be a little bit of an island of balance and reason. I would very much like to think so. My prediction is that it won't. I don't think so. I think the dynamic, even in Europe, over the long-term dynamics, this is not because of Trump, by the way. I would have said the same a year ago or 2 years ago. Unfortunately, liberal democracy requires citizens to understand what it's about, to be relatively modest in their own approach, and to prioritize the right things, to prioritize good governance, to prioritize clean governance, to prioritize friendliness, kindness towards neighbors, towards others. And all the trends over the past 25 years have gone in the other direction. Citizens are no longer understanding of what liberal democracy needs to have. And as a result, politicians are responding to that, are reacting and are giving citizens what they want: emotional satisfaction, tribalism, anger, outrage. And so I would be amazed. I would be eternally grateful, but I would be amazed if my son will have live in liberal democracy for his entire life. I don't think he will, and that's tragic.
This seems like a depressing moment to end today's conversation, but if you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Boulder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
This is a quote from Lionel Trilling, an American literary critic, intellectual from the middle of the 20th century, who wrote, "We are at heart so profoundly anarchistic that the only form of state we can imagine living in is utopian. And we are so cynical that the only utopia we can believe in is authoritarian."